Hello, a very, very warm welcome back to you. We are now going to cover the synopsis of chapter 7 of the Bhagavad Gita. We have so far covered all 7 chapters in the series entitled The Gita Decoded. Sister Denise is the speaker in the series, and she has shared her wisdom and insight as well as years of experience in the understanding of the scripture. Sister Denise, welcome back. Great to see you.
Thank you.
Sister Denise, as I look through chapter 7 and heard the answers that you've given to what the text says, I'd like to go over the message that the reader receives from chapter 7. And I see that the things that are covered are titles of God like the primeval seed. And I notice that in this chapter, God has revealed a lot of his identity to Arjuna and therefore to us. Why is it necessary that he has done this?
It's called the Bahurupi. He takes many forms. But what is his original form? So I think that the aim of the whole Gita is to enable us to be in yoga with God. So in yoga with God means you have to know who you are and you have to know who God is. In the friendly form, Krishna is the friendly form, but when you start to hear some of the other descriptions of God, you realize what's behind that friendly form. And I think basically the Gita is allowing us to go slowly, slowly to the real God, which is the incorporeal, the supreme, the one who is this extraordinarily powerful energy that enables the world to run for an entire cycle. But you know, it's hard for a human being to come face to face with God. So it's really being done incrementally. And as you get progressively purer, you understand more, and you start to be able to feel comfortable with the idea that, yeah, I can be in communication, in communion with the Supreme God.
The aspect of the three gunas has come up again. What is its relevance in chapter 7?
What you have is some difficulties of comprehension, because the three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas, refer to three different states, and God is in a steady state. So we have to make a differentiation between God, who is beyond the three gunas, and the three gunas that occur due to the effect of time. They're really all about deterioration. So everything is brought to its highest point by contact with God, and then once things come into motion, they deteriorate, they grow old, they go from sattva to rajo to tamo. And so he said in one of the verses, they are in me, but I am not in them. In other words, I know them, but I'm not subject to them. But everybody else is subject to decline.
The one phrase that did grab my attention is God says very clearly, scarcely few know who I am. Scarcely few. And that is very sobering somehow.
Well, people are not equal. People are different, very different. And there are a few people who are having that speciality, that capacity to know God. And they are very extraordinary people. And there are some, and maybe they're hidden, but they are of interest to God.
It's quite clear that God knows that people remember him and why people remember him. And I think many people who do remember God don't realize that the reason for their remembrance of God impacts on how God responds to them. I think this is one of the deepest messages in chapter 7, and especially the part of my benevolent children fall into four categories, which you redefined for us in your explanation in a previous episode.
Yeah, so Kritos, I would not say benevolent, but those who are focused on philanthropy, well, it ends up as the same thing, those who do pure action. See, benevolent means wishing good, and Sukritas is really doing good, so it's further of a word. But yeah, it is very interesting, and we, I think as a human race, we need to think about this, because the way we think about humanity is very different to the way God thinks about humanity, and it might be better for us to start looking at ourselves in the way that God looks at us, because I think we'd get a much better understanding of what humanity is and how we should relate to our human brothers and sisters.
So Denise, what would you say is the main message in chapter 7, apart from that which we've already covered?
Well, chapter 7 is called the Yoga of Gyan and Vigyan. So we need to really think about what is Gyan, what is knowledge, and what lies beyond knowledge. So knowledge is what is needed in order to be able to have yoga. So Vigyan is translated here as discrimination, which is a very subtle functioning of the consciousness. To be able to discern who God is essential in order for us to have yoga with God. God is very hidden because of being incorporeal, because of being of a different order of soul than a human soul. So we have to go beyond our normal capacity, and God does pull us there. Yeah.
I was very touched by what he said about the wise children remembering him. I got the distinct impression he's saying that if somebody remembers me without a hidden agenda, or without any agenda, that is the one whom is most dear to me. That was very touching somehow.
Well, this is the thing. You have to go deep inside yourself, and when you go very, very deep, you do touch the place where you love God. But then, whether it's karmic accounts or other agendas or whatever, but it comes as a block to actually prevent your love for God from coming into fruition. And this is what we call as sin, you see. So sin is that karma or that distraction away from God, which means God is, you know, completely open to you, but then the sin comes up and then closes everything down, which is a great tragedy. And I think the whole striving of this is to get rid of that, so that there is nothing between you and God, you know. And of course, God is going to be very pleased with someone who just wants there to be nothing between me and God, and who isn't trying to use God for their own desires or whatever. Just, you know, I, the soul, recognize God, appreciate God, love God. That is it, you know. That is the highest.
So Denise, I once heard that friendship between two people can change the brain chemistry of those individuals. Does having a relationship with God rewire your brain? Does it have an impact on the brain?
I would think it does. You know, when you're having yoga, you are entering into a different frequency. See, because the brain is operating on the basis of electrical frequencies, right? And so when you're in harmony with yourself and you're in harmony with God, that harmony completely resets your whole physical body. And this is also why we have many disciplines of purity, because your body, your whole body, not just your brain, your whole body, the whole nervous system becomes rewired. And it's to do with harmony. So when you are sort of at a high, operating at a higher frequency, then you, you know, you're evolving, you're getting, when you're lower frequency, that's tamo, coming back to the three gunas. As you become more and more soul conscious, more and more God conscious, so your vibration is less and less tamo, it starts to become rajo. And then ultimately it can become sato. But sato vibration, the stage of being like God, like a deity, that's very, very high. But that is what the Gita is leading us to, provided we interpret it effectively and we actually do the practice of reaching there.
Sister Denise, I took this up in the previous episode, but I'd like to again. So many people across the globe who are with God in their prayers, etc., and go to God, speak to God, feel that God does not know that they exist or doesn't hear them because they don't see the proof of that. You know how people have become, we want proof of everything, seeing is believing mentality, and God doesn't operate on that principle. Okay, so could you share something for those individuals who seem to believe that, you know, despite what I'm doing, God does not hear me?
God does hear, but we cannot make God do something if it's not time. So one thing is that God will respond, absolutely. But you know, you make one little prayer asking for one big thing, it's not commensurate, you know. So it has to be commensurate in order to get any results.
Okay, so what you're saying is, the more you direct your energy up north, the more it will come back south headed in your direction?
You can say that, but I think people, you know, they're impatient, they make assumptions, I make a little prayer and God has to do everything. It doesn't work like that. You know, there is this expression, tapasya, this striving, you know. If you want something, anything in this world, you know, say you say, okay, I want to enjoy the life of a wealthy doctor. Well, you have to study medicine, you have to develop your practice, you have to become highly skilled, and so many different little areas you have to become fulfilled in order to actually fulfill that. You can't just say, okay, I think I'll have this, and then it just comes. No. You want something expensive, you have to pay the price. So you want God to do everything for you, he will say, why should I? You know, you do for yourself, you know. So people really don't understand God, they don't know how to use God. You know, sometimes in our teachings of Brahma Kumaris, God will say, you know, you're not using me. How do you use God? First of all, what you want to be doing is God's work. So if you want to do God's work, you want to be an instrument for God's work, you have to be connected with God so that God can, you know, give you the energy or bring God's own agenda into it. And then it works very well. But if you want to do it all yourself, you don't have the power. You see, you have to be linked with God in order to get this kind of thing to happen. It's not going to work otherwise.
Mm. What I also found noteworthy about chapter 7 is that the obstacles in one's relationship with God is also very clearly enunciated, and that paints a very realistic picture, doesn't it? It's not all, sunshine and roses.
No, well, you have to deal with your dark side. You have to deal with your vices. And God makes it very clear that, lust is a major obstacle. And that is what makes the soul really dark.
Why is lust a major obstacle? How does it make the soul dark?
You want to go to God. You want to go to the highest level of purity. You want to go to God, the incorporeal. And then on the other hand, you want to totally lose yourself in flesh. You know, it's the opposite direction. God is spirit. Lust goes to the body. It's total engagement and use of the body for taking sense pleasure. From a spiritual point of view, is absolutely the antithesis of the spiritual achievement, you see. And for the world to continue in the way that it does, lust is a requirement. But in order for us to go to a new world, this is after all Raj Yoga, this is after all for the world, the heavenly world, the paradise world, which is what God is creating, it is a world of purity. It is a lust-free world. It is a world where procreation is not done through sexual copulation. And so one has to have the sanskaras of such a level of purity to completely change it, you see. And now, of course, lust is very much associated with violence and violation of people, worst violation of women, you see. And God is not keen on such things. It's equivalent to murder in his eyes. Rape.
Okay. Sister Denise, I get the distinct impression that the way God describes his relationship with human beings and our relationship with him, it seems that to go to God, we should have a hunger to be with God. A deep, deep need to be with God for God's sake. Alone.
Yes.
Okay. What feeds this hunger? Because we have a number of traits that feed all our other personality traits, especially our dark side. So what feeds this quest for God? Are you born with it? Can you develop it? There is somebody watching the show right now who says, who understands, I don't know God at all. And I have never really been interested in God. I have had a vague awareness of the existence of God. However, I'd like to change that. Are you born with this trait? Can you develop it? Can you increase it? Or
I don't think it's like that. I feel that you either have it or you don't have it. And so in that case, you're born with it. But it's not that it's part of your birth, it's something that's in the soul that comes with you for life after life after life. So your interest in God is something that's been with you for many, many lives. And I can see very well a situation or a condition where you lose the awareness that you have that much of a hunger for God. And something will awaken it, and you will discover that I am one of these people who must have God. But it's not that you can just develop it. I don't think it works like that. It's more like a recognition that God is very necessary for me. And as I said, people are different, you know. And there's, as also we talked about earlier, there's a few people who have such a huge capacity in their soul to fill with God, but they are rare, you see. Most people, they, you know, they're empty, but they get filled easily, satisfied with little, and okay, that's enough. Then there are other people, they have a vast hole in their soul the size of the universe that can only be filled with God. Those are the special ones.
And those, that is the one that God addresses when he says, the wise, such a one is very dear to me.
I think so.
And Sister Denise, I got the distinct impression that the virtue of sincerity, the quality of sincerity, is pivotal to a successful relationship with God. Because, you know, people can fake human relationships, and many do, whereas this is one relationship that is 100% real.
Yeah. You know, something that happens is in your quest for God, you encounter various things. And one thing that happens to people, people may be, you know, in a spiritual practice, participate in a particular ashram or church or synagogue or mosque or whatever. And something may happen in that arena which will make you actually turn away from God. And that happens where you get disillusioned, disappointed with the representatives of God, you see. And then that's a very negative thing to do, to be an instrument to turn people away from God. That counts pretty badly in terms of your accumulation of sin, you know, because what you're supposed to do is bring people towards God. But if you become instrument to turn them away, you leave people in a kind of limbo. And I think that this is one of the tests that a yogi has to take, and that is that you have to really not allow anything, even in terms of the representatives of God or whatever, never allow that to turn you away from God. You may have to move to a peripheral position and continue in your movement towards God, but it is a negative thing to do, to say, okay, well, I've been abandoned, I've been misrepresented, or things in the name of God are done, I don't like this, I'm going away, you see. I can't allow that to happen. You have to find a way to stay with it. A lot of situations do that.
Steadfastness, then.
Steadfastness, yes.
There's quite a serious and yet moving note to this episode, and thank you for that. So there you have it. Sister Denise has shared her views on the essential message that is contained within Chapter 7. And I would invite you, those of you sitting at home watching this episode, to go through Chapter 7, and then once you've read it, ask yourself, which category do you fall into as far as the benevolent children of God is concerned? Which category do you fall into? What is your relationship with God? What do you want from God? And how do you relate to God? Those are the questions that one needs to answer for oneself. And also, what is it that you want from God? And do you feel that you have a relationship with God at the moment? All of these questions arise when one looks at Chapter 7, and I will invite you to think about it more deeply. Sister Denise, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us, and we will see you for the next episode where we will take up Chapter 8 of the Bhagavad Gita. Thank you so much for joining us, and goodbye.